I think we're all pretty much aware of how the pace of life is getting faster and faster. There's, you know, new products coming online, everything. There's new technologies. 30 years ago, life seemed to be so much gentler and slower. And it's going to get faster and faster. Again, we better wake up to that fact.
My guest today is Peter Russell. Peter initially studied mathematics and theoretical physics at Cambridge University, but shifted to experimental psychology due to a growing fascination with the human mind. He journeyed to India to explore meditation and Eastern philosophy and returned to the UK to hold the first ever research position on meditation psychology in Britain. He also holds a postgraduate degree in computer science and was an early contributor to three-dimensional displays, foreseeing virtual reality by two decades. In the 1970s, he pioneered human potential seminars in the corporate sector, offering programs on creativity, stress management, personal development, and sustainable development for clients such as IBM, Apple, Barclays Bank, Shell Oil, British Petroleum, and more. He's an author with over 10 books to his name. His most recent book is Letting Go With Nothing, which we'll be discussing some of the concepts here today. And he's also on the faculty of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and several other organizations dedicated to serving humanity. Thank you, Peter, for coming on, sharing your time and knowledge with us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So first of all, noetic science, I think that's an area that a lot of people aren't too familiar with. Can you explain what that is and in what capacity you're involved?
Yes, noetic. It comes from the Greek word. It's one of the Greek words for mind, but it's not about the thinking mind. We use mind in two different ways. One, the thinking mind, but also we use mind in a more general sense of just consciousness. What is in my mind, the experience, and it refers to that. And the Institute was started by the astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who was on the second trip to the moon. And on his way back, he had nothing to do for several days except just watch the Earth getting closer and closer, taking photographs, and realized here was this beautiful blue pearl floating in space, and there were no boundaries on it. And it was just one place, and there was one humanity. And he just saw this unity of everything and realized the biggest problem facing humanity was around consciousness. We weren't seeing the unity in our minds. We were all feeling separated. And so he set up the Institute of Noetic Sciences in about 72, explore consciousness. That was the motivation, to explore consciousness, do research on consciousness, because he felt that was what was really missing. So that's what the Institute is about, and that's how it came into being. I got involved very early on, not in any sort of formal way. I discovered it for a year or two after it was founded and spent time hanging out with a lot of the people and spoke at a number of their conferences. And I was very closely aligned with what they were doing. And they made me a fellow very early on. So I've been a fellow, which is just an honorary position, really. It doesn't mean anything. So I haven't done any actual research there myself. I've sat in on things and discussions and all of that stuff. So I've been closely aligned with it.
It's so interesting that from literally taking a step back and looking at the world from a different perspective, he had that realization that we are all connected and that we need to look at it from basically a greater distance, a bigger point of view than just our narrow-minded point of view that we have here.
Yeah.
You became interested in spirituality early on, right, in your career. Was that something you were always interested in? You took a pretty big leap in, you moved to India, correct? You studied with the spiritual leader Maharishi, and that was a time, I believe it was in the 60s, that was considered way more taboo and fringe to do something like that. Can you explain your motivations for how you got interested in that path?
Yes. Initially, I wasn't interested in spirituality as such, or religion. I'd rejected a religion when I was about 13 and went through. I was brought up Protestant Church of England in a very loose way, and like we all were in that stage. And then I realized that the Nicene Creed was something I was meant to believe. I believe in one God, the Father Almighty, the Maker. What? I can't believe this stuff.
Mm.
And so I just left church. I told my parents I'm not going to church anymore. And they said, fine. So I rejected religion as just a load of old mumbo jumbo from past centuries. And I was a mathematician. I was studying mathematics, and I moved into theoretical physics. And I was intrigued by the fact that science, theoretical physics, mathematics may describe how the universe works, but the one thing it doesn't predict is consciousness. And yet science prides itself on its power of prediction. If it has any theory, you test it by what does it predict, and if its prediction is correct. But Western science doesn't predict that any of us should ever have an experience. We should just be biological robots doing everything we're doing, but not actually having this inner experience, which we all know, probably the one thing we absolutely know for sure is that we are aware. And science doesn't have anything at all to say about that, which we know for sure, within which all science takes place. I mean, most of it it's in the mind, it's thinking, coming up with theories. And that just struck me as really weird. And so I wanted to start exploring consciousness. I did a degree in neuropsychology. They weren't interested in consciousness. I learned a lot about the brain and everything. Then I realized the way to study consciousness was internally, not by strapping electrodes on the skull, but by actually going inside one's own mind. And the people who done that were the monks, the spiritual adepts, the recluses, people who just sat down to meditate, basically sat down to meditate and watch what was going on in their own mind. And so that led me to an interest in meditation. And I tried various things and then came across TM, Transcendental Meditation, which really worked for me. And I got fascinated by the Maharishi and his teachings. And he invited me out to India. And so I went out to study with him. And that was in 1969 at his ashram there. And that was a really, I think, important time. I realized, first thing I realized was there was something to spirituality after all, not necessarily to religion, but I realized that all the religions were actually deep down, they had spiritual teachings.
Mm.
Those spiritual teachings were very similar when it comes down to it. And so I got interested in what was the core spiritual idea that gave basically sparked all the great religions. And so that became my interest, trying to distill that core and then really share it with people in ways that were appropriate for the 20th and now the 21st century rather than 1,000 years ago. And so that's how I got into this whole area.
I've had a similar experience as far as religion didn't resonate with me when I was younger either, but I have found the spiritual aspect recently and done study different philosophies, Eastern philosophies, and I'm trying to learn the holistic picture, whole picture of all the religions and Eastern philosophies. And you're right, they all come down to the same, basically same core teachings that spirituality teaches, and they're not divided up amongst all these different religions and different ideas. And then at the same time, which you mentioned also, that it's the spirituality is so closely related to science. And now I think we're starting to realize that more and more, where the science is starting to catch up with the same concepts that were taught spiritually thousands of years ago.
Yes and no. I think science and spirituality are both seeking the truth, but they're seeking the truth from different perspectives. And I think sometimes people confuse it. Science is looking for the truth about the material world, the physical world, the world we live in. And the method of science is one of basically finding ways to come to reliable truth. It's about having hypotheses, testing them, finding if there's consensus, if other people agree. So they're trying to arrive at consensus truth about the world and how it works. Whereas spirituality is looking at the inner truth, basically the truth of who we are. Science is looking at the truth of what the world is out there, the physical truth. And ultimately, spirituality is looking at who am I? What does it mean to be conscious? Who are we from the inner point of view? And it's seeking and talking about that truth there, the inner truth. That's how I see them. They're complementary aspects. One, they're both looking for truth. One is looking for truth in the world outside, and one is looking for the truth of the world within. When people say science and spirituality are coming together, I think what they're pointing to is sometimes how science is maybe agreeing with some of the statements that spirituality makes. And that happens. And sometimes I feel they're off track. There's a lot of people talking about quantum physics, and does quantum physics prove consciousness and all that stuff and spirituality. My feeling is no, not at all. It's an incredible theory that is absolutely, seems absolutely correct in physics. But I'm not sure it has any relationship to our spirituality, our inner world.
That's interesting. So you view those as two separate things, and that they're not completely, they'll never completely come together to understand the same things, because we're studying basically different aspects of the world.
Yeah. And we'll find parallels. We'll definitely find parallels in between them. And right. That's fascinating. For me, spirituality is looking at the inner world, and science is looking at the outer world. It's looking, and it's doing experiments on energy, matter, space, and time. Whereas when you're meditating, you're experimenting with what can I do with my attention, that sort of thing in meditation. So I see that they're complementary. They're like two sides of a coin, and both sides need to be explored. And at times we'll find parallels between them.
Yeah, that makes sense. So meditation, you talk a lot about meditation in your book, and you gave me some good insights, because I'm a novice meditator. And I think a lot of us, we feel like we're doing it wrong because we're trying to stay present and not have the chatter come in from the outside and take our attention off of things. And when I'm not able to do that, I feel like I'm doing it wrong. But in the book, I believe you said the practice is not one of staying present so much as it is learning to return to the present easily and without effort. That completely changes my mindset on that. It's okay to lose focus, but it's more about recognizing that you have lost focus and bringing back to the present. Right. And then I believe you mentioned that it's really more, the meditation is the training to be able to apply that in the real world. It's like meditation is the training ground for the game of life, where we can apply that experience that we gained through training and meditation to be able to stay present in our everyday lives.
Yeah. Okay, coming to the first question, first part. Yeah, there's a lot of, I think, I won't say misunderstanding, but there's a very prevalent view in our culture, in a lot of cultures, particularly in Eastern cultures too, that meditation is difficult, that the mind always wanders, you've got to try hard, you've got to try and control the mind, and it takes years of training, and people try this, and they try it, they try to control the mind, stop it wandering, and they don't get very far, and the teacher says, I told you it would take a long time, lots of training, come back in a year's time and tell me how you're doing. And there can be success on that path. I don't want to say it's wrong. So it's not what we do. We just say, are you doing it correctly? I don't think there's any correct practice. There's many different practices. And what I'm interested in is practices which are much easier, which are absolutely effortless, which don't involve focusing the mind, which allow the mind to settle down quietly and easily into a state of quietness, stillness. So they're basically allowing, and the emphasis is on allowing, the thinking mind to settle down. You can't beat the thinking mind. It's always going to keep coming back, as you discover. There's no way. And that's the most common complaint I hear from people is, oh, I can't meditate because I can't stop thoughts. You'll never stop thoughts. That's, once you accept the fact you'll never stop thoughts coming in, then you're on your way, because you can't beat them. The thing is, what do you do when you notice you've got a thought? And in many techniques, Vipassana, TM, other techniques, the basic instruction is come back to the present moment. Don't follow the thought any further. When we're engaged in a thought, we're caught up in it, where it's interesting or important, whatever, and then suddenly we wake up, it's like, oh my God, I was caught up in that thought. Then instruction is just return the attention to the present. Now, the words are important, understanding we've got to become present. We're already present. We are present the whole time. There is only the present moment. There is only ever this moment. Mm. And in this moment is all this experience happening here. And there's all my memories of the past and all my ideas about the future. They're all happening in this present moment and the next present. We are already present. So what happens when you realize you've been thinking, you in fact become present to the fact your attention was caught up in a thought. So your attention was caught up in the past or the future. So your attention wasn't in the present moment. So it's your attention itself is happening in the present moment, but it is focusing outside the present moment. And nearly all thoughts in meditation you'll find are nothing about something other than the present moment. Mm-hmm. So when you just don't follow the thought anymore, your attention naturally shifts from the thought, which is about the past or the future. Your attention can relax back again into, here I am. Here I am sitting here. Here's my body. Here's the sounds around me. And I can just relax into the present moment. That's what I mean by it's not so much returning to the present. It's letting the attention return to the present. And then in the meditations I teach, allowing the mind just to relax there, just allowing the mind to relax, which is allowing the attention to relax. So we're not focusing so much. It's like an open, expanded awareness. And then a minute later or two, you'll be off again, caught up in some thought. And when you recognize it, just come back and say, yes, okay. And here I am. Here's my experience. Here's my body, whatever it is. Here's the feelings I'm having. So that's why I say the practice is returning the attention to the present rather than trying to stay there. You'll never stay present. I say you'll never. If you do years and years of very hard practice, you might be able to.
So
you're always present, but you'll never, the attention will keep wandering off outside the present moment. So you'll never stop the attention wandering off, but it's okay, come back. And so as the more you meditate, the more that coming back to the present just becomes a natural skill, which just becomes easier and easier. And then, as you say, we can begin to do that more in life when we're caught up in thoughts in the middle of life. Then the meditation, we bring that in and say, let me not follow that thought anymore and just come back. Oh, yes, here I am in this busy street or whatever it is. Here I am.
So you do get better with experience at focusing the attention, but also you have to manage expectations going in, right? And not have these, I hear of people meditating for 1, 2, 3 hours a day, and they stay in these blissful states and focus their attention the entire time on their meditation. And I think that's what a lot of us just hear, and we're trying to replicate that in some way. And we try and we're not able to do it, and we get frustrated. And
right. But you see, what you're hearing is people saying it's about focusing the attention. And as I say, there are certainly techniques which work on focusing the attention, but I don't think they work very well. That's the techniques you've been trying, is focusing the attention. Mm. And what I'm suggesting is not focusing the attention, but just shifting the direction of the attention. So when you realize your attention has been caught up in a thought, you don't have to do anything to become present. You realize the present is already there. And so the attention is naturally back in the present moment. You don't have to focus the attention. If you try to focus the intention, it will actually make it less easy. You won't be so relaxed.
Right.
So it's having a relaxed attention. And this is really important because, you know, the idea, say, is so prevalent that meditation involves focusing the attention, which, as I say, there are many techniques that do that. But I found the most effective way is not to focus the intention, but to just practice allowing the attention itself to relax, which is opposite to focusing. So you're allowing the attention to relax. And as you do that, your whole being begins to relax. If you're focusing the attention on something, you're going to create some tension in the mind, which is the opposite to the relaxation that I think meditation should be leading to.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. That's good. That's good advice. I think we've all had those things that we call, we realize something important or we have some kind of epiphany, but how is that different than the monkey mind or the chatter in your head? Is that your higher self letting you know something, or is there a difference at all?
Yes, there is. There is a big difference. A lot of the time, the monkey mind is really, it's the ego at work, wanting this, wanting to stop this. It's all about the monkey mind, in one way or another, it's about keeping things in order, controlling the mind, controlling things, getting what you want, that sort of thing. It's the monkey mind is trapped in the past and future. That's where it's going. And the monkey mind is always coming up with ideas about what you should do. I should do this, or I should do that, whatever it is. Mm. And deeper down is what I call our authentic self, which is just who we are without the monkey mind. It's like that true self. So when you come back in meditation, you come back to that stillness, like, oh yes, here I am. There's no thoughts. There's no monkey mind chattering away. Then I can have insights about what to do from that place. The difference, the big difference between them is that the monkey mind has two qualities. Well, one, it's usually about doing something. Any insights you have are telling you what to do. You've got to do this, do that, et cetera, et cetera. And it also has a sense of urgency about it, insistence. You've got to do this. You've got to do this now. You've got to make this phone call now. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. It has this urgency and insistence, and it's about doing something in the world. When things are coming from our more authentic self, they tend to be realizations not so much about what to do, but more about shifts in how we see things. We were talking about that with anger or something. Mm. That from seeing somebody as there's a problem, whatever they did, coming back, just seeing, oh, I see how they could have been this. That's coming from our true self. And the ideas, the insights that come from our true self, generally, I would say, they don't have an urgency. They don't have that urgency. They're not about something to do. They're more about how to see things. And the way of seeing nearly always brings the qualities, I think three qualities. One is it's a more loving, compassionate way of seeing. The monkey mind is very adversarial. The authentic self is much more compassionate. It's coming from a more peaceful perspective, whereas the monkey mind is something's wrong. There's anxiety. I've got to get this sorted out. It's not at peace, the monkey mind. And the other quality of the authentic self is there's a truth to it. It feels true. So when you recognize, oh, this is why the person was getting upset or why they did this. Oh, yes, there's a quality of truth to it. So that's, I would say, if it's coming from our authentic self, it usually has those qualities of it's compassionate, it's loving, it's coming from a peaceful place, and there's a quality of truth to it.
That's great. Yeah. I find we all have problems with seeing things from different perspectives, that we understand and realize that we're all one, that we're actually only hurting ourselves when we hurt someone else.
Yeah.
From that perspective of, I don't want to hurt myself. It's easy to change your anger that's projecting on someone else. You also talk a lot about negative emotions and letting go, that we have to first remove the resistance to the feeling in order to let it in fully, that we have to let it in and experience it fully in order to fully let it go. Yeah. And I have a lot of trouble with that, but I do have experience with physical sensations, or I do some experimenting with fasting. I was a wrestler when I was younger, so I have experience with hunger in dealing with that. And I know what to expect. I know what it feels like. I know that it's not hurting my body. And so I'm not suffering because of that, because I'm just acknowledging the feeling. I know what it is. I'm saying it's fine. And I'm going on about my day, and it eventually goes away. But then when it comes to negative emotions, I have a tougher time doing that. So I'm trying to figure out how I go about getting better at that. And I think it might be a simple answer of more experience and letting it in and just being accepting of the emotion. Is that
yes, but it's more subtle than that, but that's right. That's the general direction. First of all, it's not about getting rid of any emotion. Some emotions are great. We want them. We love them. They're fine. But sometimes we get caught up in emotions that we may be angry at somebody and we just don't want to. We want to get rid of that emotion. And that's what we try to do. We try to get rid of it. We try to think about something else. If you're angry about something, oh, go and think about a nice day at the seaside or something. Or ignore it altogether, or push it to the back of your mind, which doesn't make it go away at all. It's just hiding it. It's just hiding the emotion. So when you've got an emotion that you want to let go of, then this is where the technique applies. And I retranslate or reframe letting go as, first of all, letting be, rather than trying to get rid of an emotion, this is what you're pointing to, is to let it be, to allow it to be there. And before you can do that, you have to actually let it in, allow it in. And this is where the resistance bit comes in that you mentioned, because usually if it's an emotion we don't like if it's, let's take anger, it's not a nice emotion to have. We don't like it. And so the tendency is to resist really experiencing it. We feared if I really let this anger in, I'd go out and thump that person. It wouldn't be good. So I better control my anger. I better not look too deeply. I need to keep it away or I'm going to misbehave.
That blow up at your boss, your wife, your friend.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when I say to feel it, first of all, there's two aspects to any emotion. There's what I call the story, and there's the feeling in the body. There's always something going on in the body. It's any emotion, it comes from the Latin, actually, ex motare. It means to move out. It's a tendency to begin moving. And psychologists call it an action tendency. So if anger, you want to go and thump somebody. If it's greed, you want to almost like that feeling of grabbing, pulling in. If it's depression, is that feeling of moving back and cutting off. There's some sort of subtle sense. Nothing's happening in the body, but there's a sort of preparation for movement. That's what the feeling bit is. And then there's the thought. And the thought is, that stupid so-and-so, why did he do that? He wasn't thinking of me, blah, 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 blah. And the thought is triggering that feeling sensation. There's two things going on, and they feed back on each other. And so there's two ways you can approach it. You can either look at the thought and say, is that really true? What was he or she thinking about? Did they have a bad night? What are they thinking of me? Have I upset them in some way? There could be a whole lot of reasons. So rather than just judging them and saying they're stupid, whatever it is, we can look at them in a new light and say, hang on, let me try to understand their position. And if you do, then that can often help the emotion just release completely. Because if you realize, oh my God, they were looking at this. They were thinking I said this. No wonder they did this. And when you see that, then you just, yes. And the other side, the side you're pointing to, is we can let in what's happening in the body. But first of all, because we're resisting it, we don't want to feel the anger. What I suggest people do is, first of all, notice any sense of resistance there may be, because the resistance is keeping it out. So before you can let it in, just notice any sense of resistance in the body, maybe a tightness, something like that. And if you can let that soften and relax, then you'll begin to notice more what the actual feeling is in the body, what's actually happening. So you can sit back and say, this is what's happening. Oh, there's this sensation here. And I hadn't realized there's a tension in my legs. It's like you can begin to discover all the little things that are happening in the body related to that emotion. And as you do, as you stop resisting them and allow them in, what you'll generally find is they dissolve. It's almost like a metabolism. They're metabolizing. Mm-hmm. As you open up to them, say, oh, hello. Oh, you're there. Oh, okay. When you stop resisting them, then they start softening and dissolving. And you'll again find the emotion will begin to subside. It's the resistance in a way that keeps it in place.
Yeah, I find also that the understanding goes a long way to alleviating negativity or anxiety, right? I may feel like I have a million things to do, but when I actually sit down and write it out, I only have four or five important things to do. Or is that related to, I guess, understanding and simplicity goes a long way in alleviating?
I think that's one example how, you know, you're getting yourself wound up because you think I've got so much to do and you're probably feeling frustrated or some emotion. And when you look at it clearly, as you say, when you look at it and you realize, actually, I've only got four or five things I have to do, then you're beginning to see things more clearly. And so that thought system that was making you feel so hurried and frustrated or whatever it was and anxious, that thought system is relieved. And so you feel better. It's, oh, there's not too much to do. If there's only four or five, then you can say, okay, what's the first one? Let's get, what's the first one to do? Get out of the way. Yeah. And you just knock them off one by one.
Yeah, exactly. You talked more about, I think, simplicity. You said, instead of the truth becoming progressively diluted and veiled as it's passed on, today our discoveries are reinforcing one another. We're seeing through the differences of the world's faiths, past their cultural trappings and interpretations to what lies at their heart. As we strip away layers of accumulated obscurity, the core message not only becomes increasingly clear, it gets simpler and simpler, and the path becomes easier and easier. And my experience with that is completely true. The more I learn about the world and how it works, it's simpler. And I have a framework or a filter to filter things through. But at the same time, the more I learn, the more I realize how little I know. So I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around that concept and how those two things are related.
That, yes, what I was saying there wasn't about what we know about the world. It's not about knowing the world. It's the other side of the equation we were talking about earlier. It's about the spiritual side. And I was talking about how, coming back to where we started, really, how I think all the great spiritual traditions come from the same basic root. Mm. And one of those ideas is letting go. There's a core idea of just about every tradition. Another idea is the idea of oneness, that we're all ultimately deep down the same, those sorts of ideas. And what I was, the background to that statement was, I think what has happened in the past is somebody has woken up, become enlightened, whatever you want to call it, and realized, oh, wow, hang on, this wonderful state of consciousness, whatever you want to call it, and it's, I feel at peace, and there's unconditional love. I want to share this with my friends. And so they tell other people, look what I've discovered. And their friends get maybe 90% of it, but not quite all of it. Pretty good. They go and tell their friends, who get 90% of what they tell them, and it gets passed on from one person to another, and bits get lost, bits get added in. And you do that over hundreds of years. It's like that game of telephone where you pass a whisper message down the line, totally different. And I see that's what's happened with religion. It's passed down from one culture to another. It's translated from one language to another. And it ends up often very different from what the initial teaching was. And so, as I said, I'm interested in what is that initial wisdom that's there. And what I see happening today is that there's so much exploration. There are so many opportunities to explore this through meditation, through different teachers. We are all beginning to come together in a way, begin to understand that same basic wisdom. And the more we do that, then what I was saying was the simpler it gets, because so much has been added on through history. It gets simpler the more we get closer to what is that core teaching. It gets simpler and simpler. And then it gets easier and easier. And that comes back to what we were talking about meditation. When you get this idea that goes around that meditation is extremely difficult, you've got to control the mind, blah, 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 it's not very easy. But as you begin to realize what that essential truth is, I don't think any of the great teachers were saying you've got to control the mind. They're more saying you've got to discover what that truth is by just relaxing the mind. Yeah. Then it gets easier and easier. So I was talking about that, the general awakening that's happening in the world today to spirituality. We are, in a sense, collectively honing in on what that truth is.
And that seems to go with so many things. It's just the understanding. The deeper understanding of complex things seems to make most things simpler, whether it's spirituality or business or education, whatever it is, that seems to be the case with most things.
Yes. Although I'm, as a physicist, I'm still interested in the stuff that's going on in theoretical physics. And that seems to be getting more and more complex with time. Yeah.
Do you think that's because we're just discovering more information or uncovering more information and adding to?
Not really, no, not so much that. It's because some of the theories don't work properly. And the more we look into them, like the more, oh dear, So take cosmology. There's so many different theories going around. No one knows which one is
right
of the universe and things. So I think both things are happening. I think there is a sense of getting simpler, but also the more knowledge we have, the more we explore it, the more we think about things, we discover other complexities that we didn't know were there.
Yeah, that makes sense. So as far as sharing information, knowledge, wisdom, right? I know you can't force that on people, because even if it is true, you can still traumatize people and push them away by doing that. So I know platforms like this are a great way to share information and get knowledge out there. How do you recommend doing that? And
that's one of the big challenges in terms of, Toya, you're asking about this podcast or just generally?
Just in general, I've heard perspectives such as you can't force knowledge or anything on anyone. You have to be the light and let them see what you're doing, and they then ask questions and you can share information.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it comes back to that old parable of Jesus about sowing the seed. Some falls on fertile ground, some on stony ground. And I see it as a very apt parallel. We are casting seeds of our ideas. I just want to share what I found useful in my life that's helped me in this area, and just share that. And some people will hear it, and I know people hear it, and it's very important for them. They get from it. I share it. I put it in my book. The Letting Go of Nothing book is a book that very much I wanted to put out there. It's just an encapsulation of how I see the sort of really the essence of what spirituality is about, the letting go side. I put it out there. You come across it. Some people come across it. Others don't even notice it, whatever. But I put it out there, and then you get in touch with me. You might mention someone else. Other people get in touch. And then that fuels me and my own ideas. So we're all learning from each other. So I'm a great fan of that. I just put things out there, and a lot of people won't resonate with it, fine. But those who do resonate with it, great.
It's not about these are the steps that you need to do. It's more about this is what I did. This is what worked for me. And it may work for you as well, but you also have your own path, and you do have to find what works for you yourself. You can't just follow someone else's path
And that's what I tend to do. There are people who say, do this, do that, which can be useful if you want to do a particular step-by-step technique. I just throw out, this is what I found useful. I just share it in case it helps you.
So you're involved in technology quite a bit. I believe you have a doctorate in computer science. Is that correct?
Postgraduate degree, not a doctorate, but a postgraduate degree, yeah.
So you're well in tune with technology and where it's headed. And
I'm not practicing it, but that goes back. My degree is 50 years old. It's probably the most out-of-date degree you could have. A degree in computer science from 50 years ago. We were all doing machine code programming back then.
I've seen some cool things you've done. You have some videos up of AI avatars of yourself, interviewing yourself. That's one of the first times I've seen that. You have a chat bot on your website, PeterBot, right? That will give information based on your papers and your teachings and research. So that's unique and interesting. And you've explained that specific tools or any species that uses tools and innovation to manipulate their environment will trigger an exponential spiral of innovation. That through the accelerated pace of evolution, exponential growth is inevitable, and that the world is transformed faster than ecosystems and institutions can adapt. So can you explain that further, your thoughts on that?
Yes. I think we're all pretty much aware of how the pace of life is getting faster and faster. There's new products coming online, everything. There's new technologies. 30 years ago, life seemed to be so much gentler and slower. And it's going to get faster and faster. Again, we better wake up to that fact. The reason for this is, one reason is we're trying to make things go faster. We're trying to make things more efficient. But there's a deeper reason that runs right through human history. And that is any invention or innovation tends to improve efficiency. And it also paves the way for more inventions. So what I say is that innovation breeds further innovation. And because it makes it more efficient, the future innovations, things naturally begin to speed up. And you can see it going back throughout human history. We used simple tools for hundreds of thousands of years. Then we moved into agriculture 20,000 years ago, but that spurred the movement into cities 5,000 years ago. And then the Industrial Revolution 300 years ago, it started 250 years ago, that got faster and that made things more efficient. So when the Information Revolution came along, that happened even faster. And now as we're moving into the intelligence age, that can happen even faster still. So it's a process that's inevitable because innovation keeps breeding further innovation, and the efficiency of the new innovations make new innovations even more efficient. And so the acceleration I see as an inevitable part of any technological development. So I see it's not just human beings, but any species anywhere in the cosmos that is an intelligent and conscious species with hands or some means of developing tools and technology is going to find itself, its development accelerating faster and faster and faster. And which means, you know, where we're going in the years ahead is going to be unbelievably fast, the rate of change.
So a species that is capable of innovation is, would you say that's their core purpose is to create and to be innovative? It's not like we're going to stop now if there's dangers of AI in the future. Like that's not going to happen.
There's no stopping it, however wise we may become. I think if you have the ability to create, to change the world, I think a species is going to want to use that to improve its welfare, to improve its chances of survival. So we started moving into agriculture because it meant we could survive the seasons better. We could farm, we could actually herd animals. It made life more safe, more secure. Hopefully it did, who knows? And we do that. Coming much more recently, when computers came along, we thought, oh yes, this will save us time. We can do this more efficiently. We can apply it to many other tasks. And so it's just a natural tendency of any species, I think, to want to improve its conditions if it can. Now, you know, human beings are unique in the fact that, first of all, we have hands with opposable thumbs, which are very flexible manipulators. Other chimps and things, they have pretty flexible hands. And we have complex brains. And we have language, which allows us to think, to share information with each other. When you bring those three things together, that's when you have a really innovative species. It can think, it can work things out, it can actually control things, and it can share ideas with each other. As, hey, if you chip the stone this way, it makes it a sharper thing. Mm. And so we can share information. And so those three things together make a species more innovative. But I don't think the great apes, they don't have language like we do. They have some very rudimentary language, but they don't have a sophisticated language which can convey meaning and abstract ideas and all those sorts of things and begin to understand the universe. On the other hand, when you look at cetaceans, which are whales and dolphins, what you find there is, again, very large brains, much larger than ours. They seem to be pretty intelligent. They have language, we don't know what it is, but they clearly have sophisticated languages, but they don't have hands. They have the tool. When the bones are safely wrapped up in blubber and they've been there for several million years. So they don't have tools. They don't have technology. So they can't change the world. And so they're very happy as they are. But if they suddenly did have hands, it's, oh, maybe if we built this or did this or built some underwater thing here, that would make life easier. Whatever. We could herd the fish all into one pool here underwater and start building underwater canals or something. But they don't have hands. So I think they're blessed with not having hands. And so they're not on, their evolution is moving forward very slowly. They've been around whales for 40 million years and been slowly evolving, but not like the pace of change that we have today. They're just undergoing normal animal evolution. What we're going through is a whole cultural, technological evolution.
Yeah, because it's not like we invent the internet and now we save ourselves time. So we use that extra time to relax and have fun, but we use that extra time to do more innovation and work. And the same with AI comes along, and now we have even better tools to make ourselves more efficient and do more innovation. So it's just going to exponentially increase as time goes on.
Yeah, and keep us busier and busier. Yeah.
But are there any examples of, let's say, I believe you said it inevitably leads to failed institutions and ecosystems. Do you have, can you provide some examples of what that might look like?
I think a lot of the global issues we're facing, climate change, lack of resources, pollution, I think our systems, financial systems are pretty unstable at the moment. A lot of the issues we're facing come from the acceleration. Just to take climate change, for example, because we've been burning fossil fuels at an accelerating rate, and that accelerating rate has come because technology is accelerating. The number of people on the planet is also on a similar accelerating curve, well, it has been at least till recently. And we're finding more and more uses or more and more things it can do, how to use it. So that acceleration in that technology means that acceleration consumption means that accelerating production of CO2, which we're now seeing is beginning to shift the climate in ways which we don't quite know where it's going to go. But it comes back to that basic acceleration that's there. That's not our fault. The fact that we may be having, the way we use some of our tools and technology, that's our fault, but the acceleration isn't our fault.
It's our nature. Inevitable.
Yeah, it's inevitable it's going to happen. And so I see that is actually behind a lot of the things that are going wrong.
So in a sense, it's inevitable. It's not our fault. We ride that train until it crashes, and then we deal with what happens at that point, at that time. Is that kind of what you think?
Yes, similar. I wouldn't say until it crashes. It is crashing. It's unraveling. The system.
Well, we know it is. We don't know how to stop it, and we probably can't, even if
we don't know where it's going. We have no idea where AI is going. No idea. There's so many different possibilities. Maybe a lot of them will happen. Positive ones, negative ones. We're in for a ride that's going faster and faster. And on one side, it's going to lead us to technology beyond our imagination, beyond our dreams, but also to a world that's beginning to fall apart at the seams at the same time. So we're going to just see more of both. So it's a question of how do we handle that? How do we maintain our own sanity and equanimity as the world keeps on speeding up and go into even more sort of unpredictable changes? So it's a question of how do we keep stable in ourselves? How do we do that? How do we keep flexible in our thinking?
Yeah. How do we not worry about it and enjoy the ride at the same time?
Yep. And enjoy it, just to go out and be in the world, enjoy nature. And if you're living in a city, you don't have to be caught up in the mindset. You can actually just go out and breathe the air or something, even if it's not that clean. But just, we can just be in the present moment and say, hey, here I am, being alive now, and just as almost celebrate the fact of being alive. And that's
you have a good analogy of trees in the forest, right? So they're, can you go through that real quick?
Yeah. It's like I said, we need to be more flexible. If trees in a forest are facing a storm, then they need to be flexible, so they can bend with the wind. If it's rigid, you'll see a rigid fence will blow over, but a tree will sway with the wind. So we need to be flexible. If we're rigid in our thinking, think, oh, this is the way I've always done things, this is how it's going to be, that's going to be no good. We need to be able to be creative, be flexible in our thinking. And trees also need to be strongly anchored in the ground. One that's got strong roots is going to be more stable. And that, for me, I translate as having strong roots in ourselves. When I'm talking about just, coming back to here I am, to not being continually caught up in worry and anxiety and frustration. It'll happen, but to be able to come back, think of coming back to the present, coming back here. That's going to be really important. And the other thing that trees in a forest, they shield the wind for each other. A tree on its own out on a plain is much more likely to be blown over. And I lived in a forest, in a cottage in a forest for many years. and there could be a storm raging, and the treetops would be waving around. Down at the ground level, the air would be still, but trees protect each other. And what that means, I think, is we're going to need community. We're not just individuals. We are communal animals, and that we're going to need community just to support us emotionally, maybe physically at times, to communicate, to share ideas, whatever it is, share resources. So community is going to become increasingly important as well.
Yeah, that's a great analogy and something good to think about. I think I know you said you lived in a more rural area. I think as you live in bigger and bigger cities, that community goes away, and that we do need to get back to that for sure. I think that helps.
But even a city, you can either be in your little cubicle, your room, in a community online the whole time. But I think also important to have physical community. We're animals that like to be with other animals of ourselves, to be together. And whether that's just meeting up in coffee shops or for dinner or going to clubs or whatever it is, we need as physical organisms to be out interacting with other physical organisms of our species and relaxing, having fun, talking, exchanging ideas. So even in a city, you can still have community, or the people who live in your apartment block, getting to know them, being with them, having dinner with them sometimes, whatever it is. You can community in the city. Out in the country, it's very similar. Probably the community more is the people who live down your street because you see them more. But it's a similar thing. You can be out in the country and be completely alone.
Well, thanks again for that.
Okay, great.
Well,
let me know when it's up on YouTube.
I will.
Okay, great.
All right, have a great day.
And you. Okay,
thanks. Bye-bye. Thanks for watching or listening, everyone. And want to thank Peter for coming on to be my guest. We covered a wide range of topics, and I hope that we shared some information that was helpful and that resonates with you. So see you on the next one.